I'm Vermont Edition co-host Bob Kinzel. Just wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier today, Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases and a leading national voice in the U.S. response to COVID-19, joined Vermont Governor Phil Scott in the governor's weekly press conference and took questions from local reporters. During the press conference, Dr. Fauci shared his optimism for an effective vaccine soon and his concerns heading into the winter months and colder weather. But Fauci stressed that the same tools he and Vermont health officials have emphasized for months, things like hand washing, mask wearing, and social distancing, will remain critical moving forward.
Whether you are in Vermont or in New York City downtown, those things work. They work in states with small numbers, like Vermont, and they work in states with big numbers, like New York and Texas and California. So that's the reason why, as I was mentioning to Governor Scott a few minutes ago, that this should be the model for the country of how you've done it. Notwithstanding that you're a small state, but it should be the model of how you get to such a low test positivity that you can actually start opening up the economy in a safe and prudent way.
Again, that was Dr. Anthony Fauci speaking earlier today in a media briefing. He arrived at the media briefing and was invited by Governor Phil Scott and accepted. And he did take questions for 25 minutes or so from Vermont reporters and one from the health commissioner, Dr. Mark Levine. We're going to talk more about safety protocols today as we continue our tradition of having a weekly health update where you get to ask questions. We don't have Dr. Fauci joining us, unfortunately, but we do have our own special guest this week. Dr. Benjamin Lee is a pediatric infectious disease specialist at the University of Vermont Children's Hospital, and he can help us contextualize what we're hearing about cases of the illness in students who have just returned to in-person learning in Vermont schools. We're also joined by Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan, as we are many weeks. Tracy Dolan, Dr. Lee, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having us.
Deputy Commissioner Dolan, as we heard earlier, there have been some cases associated with Vermont schools. In Stowe, there are no cases in students or faculty, but there have been some known cases in the community. And so school officials are keeping an eye on things to make sure that this is not something that then leads to any kind of spread within the school system. In Hartford, one high school student tested positive for the virus. And so the school certainly got in touch with the health department, has gone through all the protocol, but students are still attending in-person learning as they were scheduled to do so this week. At Crossett Brook Middle School in Duxbury, two students tested positive, and that school is closed for in-person learning this week. Though, as we heard in today's press conference, Health Commissioner Dr. Mark Levine said it's not closed because health protocol dictates it, but for other reasons, including staffing issues because of the number of people who are asked to quarantine now. So, Deputy Commissioner Dolan, this was to be expected. We were warned many times there will be cases that are associated with schools. There may even be outbreaks. That is not what we're experiencing at this point. There is no outbreak associated with any of these cases in Vermont schools. But how should we contextualize what we're feeling and hearing as schools reopen and we start to see some cases?
Thanks, Jane. You're right. This isn't an outbreak, and it is what we expected. A little earlier than we hoped. You know, it would have been nice to go through a couple of weeks and get a little bit comfortable. But at the health department, this is really in keeping with what we've been doing all along. So even though it is students at a school, and I know that makes people very concerned, as it should, and I know parents get worried, we really have a team that is doing their routine work, identifying a case, interviewing that case, reaching out to contacts, and advising them on either quarantine or isolation, depending on the situation. And so far, I don't know if you heard Dr. Levine mention, but we were called out by CDC as having the strongest contacting tracing team in the country. We reach out and get a hold of contacts within about 24 hours, 96% of the contacts. So we have a strong team doing well there. And the schools, of course, just like everyone else in Vermont, have just been fantastic, great partnership. And we really do see it as a partnership between ourselves, the schools, the communities, and the Agency of Education.
You know, it's interesting, Deputy Commissioner, we had been hearing about the concern about the start of in-person learning for K through 12 schools coinciding with the Labor Day holiday, when traditionally a lot of people travel or have gatherings, and the return of college students to Vermont from possibly from out of state for many of these colleges and universities. Do you have any sense if these cases that are associated with Vermont K through 12 schools may have had anything to do with either Labor Day or college students returning?
That's an interesting question. Dr. Levine and I were speaking this morning with the colleges, and we indicated that it's possible that this is maybe even a late summer case situation where they then entered school and were found there. So it's possible this happened even before entering school, but we do know if we're doing contact tracing, that means they were deemed infectious during the time they were at school.
But you don't have any sense that it was something from a Labor Day gathering, for example?
No, we do regularly check in with contacts if they've been at a large event. In this case, not certain if it's related to travel or to a Labor Day gathering.
I got a note from a Twitter follower who was confused about what she'd heard in the press conference when Commissioner Levine said, in the case of the high school student in Hartford, there were no known close contacts or no close contacts that needed to be contacted by the health department for tracing reasons. And in the case of the Crossit Brook Middle School cases, there were 23 close contacts, and all of them have been put in touch with the health department through contact tracers. So this Twitter follower was saying, wait a minute, how can there be no close contacts of the case in Hartford with a student? Certainly the student would live with family members or someone else. So can you clarify what you mean and what the health department means when it talks about how many close contacts there are that are being traced right now from those cases?
Sure. It is common that there are close contacts either in a workplace or in a school. In this case, it's possible that the social distancing and the masking combined resulted in no close contacts, or it's possible that the person went into the school and spent very little time, maybe had a shortened day, or it could be a number of issues. It could be that the person was not infectious during the time that they were at the school, and maybe that was unveiled during the interview, although I'm not certain of that. So there could be a variety of reasons, but we define a close contact as being within 6 feet of someone for at least 15 minutes. And so it is possible that the way they configured the school day for that person, and possibly due to limited time, that this person was actually not within 6 feet of anyone for any extended period.
Oh, I think that in this case she meant, like, wouldn't there also be close contacts that were considered in family members? So it's not that there were zero close contacts, period. It's that there are zero close contacts in the school system or in the wider community, right? There are presumably some people who have been in contact with this teenager who are also quarantining, but they may be family members.
They may be. I was actually reading through the notes here. Normally we would see that. There is a possibility that perhaps family was away. Maybe this person was on their own for a few days in their home. I'm not certain of that. But if they were in their home in a usual way and were not masking around their family, which most people wouldn't, then normally family members would be called out as close contacts. So I'd have to confirm if no associated close contacts refers to just the school and the community, or if it also refers to the family.
Got
at
it.
This time, we're saying no associated close contacts, but I'm not certain around the family piece.
Got it. Thank you for that. Listeners, if you have questions for Deputy Commissioner Dolan or for Dr. Benjamin Lee, a pediatric infectious disease specialist at the University of Vermont Children's Hospital, we'd love to hear from you. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. You can also email vermontedition@vpr.org. Dr. Lee, thank you for joining us. And can you talk a little bit about how you're reacting to the news that there are these associated cases, which, as you know, as we've talked about, we expected, and how you think people should contextualize it? Because it's either easy to either say, only three, this is great, or, oh my God, three, I'm panicking. So can you help us figure out, you know, how we might balance that news?
Yes, and thanks again for having us on the show. You know, I do think that my initial reaction was maybe a little surprised that we did have cases as early as we did, But at the end of the day, this is what we expected, that we would occasionally see cases arise. And so I'm viewing this as more or less par for the course. And I think this does demonstrate the system that we have in place is really working as designed. As was mentioned just a moment ago, this really is a partnership between the schools, the health department, families, and the medical community. And thus far, I think the system is working as we hope it should. And I would take a lot of encouragement from that and the fact that when cases did pop up, that their response was very rapid and exactly as we hoped it would be.
You spoke earlier this summer with VPR's Mitch Wortlieb, and you were talking about your optimism for the possibility of returning to in-person learning, especially for younger students, and you know what you've seen and studied about transmission of the virus among young people. How has your thinking evolved on that? You know, as we move through the summer, as we continue to get more information about this very new virus, what are you thinking right now about how likely it is that more schools can go in person full time, how likely it is we're going to be able to make it through the winter with in-person schooling, and you know how you see it from your perspective as a pediatric disease specialist?
My perspective and my thinking on this has evolved a bit. If anything, it actually has maybe become even a little bit more optimistic as far as the ability to do in-person learning for our youngest learners, meaning the elementary school students. The reason I say that is it's now a couple months later, and still Vermont has demonstrated that we have the lowest rate of COVID-19 in the country. So not only are we the safest place in the country right now to be reopening our schools, we've shown that we can maintain that low level of positivity for quite a long time. There continues to be emerging data and emerging science in terms of how well do children transmit the virus. And my review of the scientific evidence continues to indicate that children, particularly young children in elementary school age, are far less likely to become infected with the virus. And if they do get infected, less likely to pass it on. So the combination of knowing that we are the safest state in the country right now, and knowing that children continue to demonstrate less likelihood of catching the virus or passing it on, it does make me optimistic that we can have in-person learning, particularly for our elementary school age kids.
Do you think that distinction should be made as schools figure out what to do next? And as many of them are on this sort of 6-week trial period or short-term trial period of hybrid learning, that perhaps high schools, middle schools and high schools should take a different approach to in-person learning than elementary schools should?
Hi, I'm sorry, my phone cut out just for a moment. I believe you had asked, should the high schoolers and middle schoolers potentially take a different approach?
Yes, yeah.
And not necessarily. I think that the challenges that middle schools and high schools pose are a little bit different if by virtue of just the size, both of the facilities and the students themselves, it does make things like social distancing a little bit harder to do in the same amount of space. I do think we need to be mindful that middle schoolers and high schoolers, the way that they mix socially is different than younger children. But at the end of the day, and as Dr. Fauci alluded to in his talk, the strategies that keep virus transmission low are the same, regardless of the setting, regardless of the location, regardless of the age of the people involved. So, you know, I think that if anything, we do need to be more cautious with the older kids, knowing that they may be better at transmitting the virus and slightly more susceptible than the younger kids at acquiring it. But at the end of the day, the strategies to prevent transmission from occurring are the same as we would apply to the younger kids. And I would also like to follow up by saying that at the end of the day, the biggest risk in terms of children or students either catching the virus or transmitting it, ultimately, it almost always starts with an infected adult introducing the virus either to the home environment or to the school or daycare environment. So it's not just about the students. It's also about all the rest of us, the adults that they depend on, doing our job to making sure we're keeping ourselves free from infection as well.
Let's go to Sophie, who's calling in from Middlesex. Hi, Sophie. You're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hi. Hi, how are you? Can you hear me okay?
We've got you loud and clear. Go right ahead.
Wonderful. I'm very pleased with how Vermont is doing. I think we're an amazing state. I am concerned about the young kids and the teenagers all having to exercise with masks on. I was reading the CDC report, and the CDC report claims that it's not, they would recommend not wearing masks because of sweating and promoting growth of bacteria and not being able to breathe well. So I'm finding myself very concerned about the fact that I see all these kids running and exercising and with masks on, and was curious, and especially if they're getting tested once a week too for COVID. And getting temperature tested every day.
I don't think they're getting tested once a week for COVID, Sophie. I think the college students maybe, but not younger students. There's no protocol in place to test all Vermont K through 12 students. But to your broader question about, you know, is it safe for them to be exercising in these masks? Let's go to Deputy Commissioner Dolan first, and then I would like your perspective as well, Dr. Lee. But Tracy Dolan, how would you respond to Sophie?
Yes, you know, we looked at the science when we looked at the mask mandate more broadly. I know the school health team that helped to put together the back to school guidelines also looked at the science and found that it was relatively safer to be wearing the masks than not, particularly at these early stages when we want to make sure as much as possible that we start out as safely as possible in the schools. So we are not concerned about health issues. Obviously, if a child is having trouble, and is breathing very heavily and having trouble with the mask, they can step aside and take a break and take off the mask or move away from the group. But generally, my two kids are also in the school system in middle and high school, and they're having to wear the masks during PE. PE is very modified right now. I would not call it particularly strenuous. They're having fun describing what they're doing in PE. Nobody's really breaking a sweat. Let's just put it that way. But some of the sports teams are wearing them, and for the most part, I think the coaches keep an eye, but for the most part, kids are able to adapt.
What do you think, Dr. Lee? I mean, in terms of, you know, there it is harder to breathe through a mask, and it is kind of unpleasant for some people, but in terms of the risk versus reward, how do you see it?
So I would agree with what the deputy commissioner said. Thus far, I don't think that we really have any solid evidence that wearing a mask or a cloth facial covering during exercise is unsafe. I do think that, you know, all of these strategies that are being implemented, it's new for all of us, and it's something that we should continue to keep an eye on as we go forward. But I definitely think it's reasonable that children should be able to do sports with masks. A quick clarification, as far as I'm aware, I also don't believe that the CDC has specifically stated that people should not wear masks when exercising, just recognizes that there may be scenarios where it may be harder to tolerate or harder to do. I don't think there's a recommendation that it not be done. And certainly I think that it's reasonable that children especially could be expected to continue to mask while exercising or performing sports. But as with everything in the COVID era, I think it's something that we'll just need to continue to watch and monitor going forward to see what the collective experience is and see if there are opportunities for either changing or adapting the approach.
So, Dr. Lee, asking for a friend here, it couldn't possibly be for me with small children who are wearing masks. How often do parents need to make sure they're finding and washing the masks of their children, whether they're out exercising or just running around in recess and going to school?
So that's a great question. I, as the father of two young children myself, you know, find the mask is a pretty common game that's been coming up.
And make sure you bring your mask back with you is another problem.
Exactly. Exactly. So I recognize that this is, you know, in the real world, it's can be a bit of a challenge making sure that everybody's keeping track of their masks, especially for the younger kids. The recommendation is that a mask should be used for the day, and then or a cloth facial covering rather should be used for the day, and then after it's been used, it should be washed before it's used again. That does mean that in most scenarios, to the extent possible, having a supply of masks is helpful so that the children are not dependent on just the one mask that they have. So spare masks or backup masks should always be available. I agree it is a challenge to keep track of them. Children should be able to wear the same mask all day. And then that should be washed before it's used again. If a mask during the course of recess or sports or whatever gets visibly soiled or wet, that would be a reason to change the mask sooner.
It's also a problem I have noted that some children prefer one mask over all the other masks. So it's become a challenge to get the right mask with the right pattern on it to the right child at the right time at any day. But that is absolutely not a problem necessarily that either of you can solve. We got a question from Carolyn, who couldn't stay on the line. But Carolyn is quarantining from her granddaughter who just started kindergarten and just wants to know, will it be safe for her to see her grandkids in a couple of weeks? Presumably, you know, once we know more about transmission in schools. Dr. Lee, what would you say to Carolyn?
That's a great question, and it's a very challenging question. Number one, you know, I do think that it's never wrong to be appropriately cautious, especially whenever there's a new scenario such as this where the number of contacts is necessarily increasing. I do think that knowing what we know about this virus, there can be a delay between the time that we see transmission and infection starting to pop up. It does make sense to hold off for at least a few weeks before we'll have a really, really good sense of what's been happening within the schools. At the end of the day, at what point to reinitiate contact or not really does become a very personal decision that I think, you know, should be based on any individual's own risk factors, but then also, you know, an honest, open discussion with their loved ones, healthcare provider, if necessary, in terms of what the risk and benefit is. Certainly, grandkids want to be around their grandparents and vice versa. It's a challenging question because at the end of the day, I believe it's a very personal question in terms of what folks, different people are willing to tolerate or not. If she would like to reinitiate contact or see them, once again, the same strategies for reducing the risk of infection still apply. So visiting outdoors is always safer than indoors, and maintaining distance to the extent possible and keeping contact, direct contact, close contact, brief will help as well. So those are the things in addition to everybody wearing a mask or a cloth facial covering. So those are just some of the principles I would just keep in mind as people do start making these decisions about how and under what conditions to reinitiate contact with other folks.
Yeah, I really appreciate you saying that. Not only, you know, are there sort of health guidelines to follow, but it is such a personal decision for so many families, and that's what makes it so incredibly difficult to try to understand all the health implications and health guidelines as we know them and as they continue to evolve, and then still not be able to have somebody just tell you, you know, when you can see your grandchild again or what the right choice is. I understand it's really, you know, heartaching for so many families, and acknowledge that it may be your situation as well, Carolyn. Let's go to Mark calling in from Essex. Hey, Mark.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This question is in regard to the long-term impacts of COVID on kids. I've seen quite a few articles over the last couple of months in regards to what I would call anecdotal evidence of some linkages between COVID and there's a syndrome that I can't remember the name of right now, but recently there was a story out concerning a potential linkage around type 1 diabetes. So my question is, what is the evidence? What do we know? Or right now, what should we be concerned with?
Dr. Lee, could you tackle that one?
Yes, that's it's a great question. And at the end of the day, I think it is at this point still a little bit, it's still too early to really know what some of the long-term, potential long-term effects or complications truly will be. Although it does seem like it's been an eternity already since the pandemic started. It's in reality only been 9 months, and that's a in medical terms, that's a relatively short period of time. I do think that it is important that we continue to be on the lookout and monitor for potential long-term complications in individuals of all ages, children, adults, and the elderly, in terms of potential longer-term complications. Right now, I do think we probably still don't really have enough data to make any definitive determinations yet on whether or not there are clear associations between specific long-term outcomes, side effects, et cetera, with COVID-19.
Dr. Lee, I know that you're a pediatric specialist, but, you know, it's interesting because it seems to me that the first signs that COVID-19 could have long-term implications seemed to be appearing, at least early on, at least for the general public, seemed to be appearing in children who were having this inflammatory reaction after the active portion of the virus may have passed through their system. And now we're starting to see adults also experiencing these longer-term implications of COVID-19 and other health issues that are cropping up after the virus. And so that's alarming to a lot of people. We're actually going to do a whole show about this on Vermont Edition, we hope next week. But what can you say about what we are learning and about the increased concern that perhaps even healthy adults whose main concern may have been just not transmitting the virus to someone more vulnerable might be for now, who are wondering, like, oh my goodness, could this actually have a bigger implication on my life if I were to contract it?
Yeah, I think that because there are still so many unknowns, this only reinforces the idea that, being younger, being healthier, not having any known risk factors, that shouldn't provide reassurance to folks that it's just okay if they go out and not socially distance, not follow the recommended strategies to potentially prevent infection and catching COVID-19. The more and more data that we get and the more and more experience we have, I think it is likely that we are going to learn about longer-term effects that we weren't aware of even just a few months ago. So I think that that's one of the things that I would caution for patients of all ages, is that there's just still so much that we don't know. And at the end of the day, the best thing for everybody is to follow recommended public health guidance to make sure that the virus is not spreading and that we're protecting not only ourselves, but each other as well.
Tracy Dolan, how carefully is the health department watching what's happening with, these kinds of long-term symptoms as more people start to be able to describe what it's like 3 or 4 months out?
Yeah, we have a scientific advisory committee who are reviewing the data and the evidence as it comes out around particular questions. And this is one area that we are tracking. We're not doing our own primary research on it, but we are looking at the national data as best we can.
Kenny in Montpelier writes, please explain the rationale of opening schools while keeping state offices working remotely, including the Agency of Education and the Governor's Office. Deputy Commissioner Dolan?
Sure. We do have the luxury of being able to, in some cases, have staff continue to work from home. There are some staff who go in, so all agencies and buildings are not shut down. For example, at the Department of Health, we have a number of staff who work in the building and have throughout, some of our epidemiological staff, some of our laboratory staff. But where we're able to, we're still encouraging working from home. And we anticipate that as things get better, we'll have more and more people come into the office. But that's about the ability to do it. In some cases, of course, some jobs don't allow for that. And we are moving toward bringing people into the building or even in direct line service where that is necessary.
But I think Kenny seems to be suggesting that, you know, it seems like, you know, I can't think of the right word, but that it's not, why would we be asking teachers and students to return in person if we don't think it's safe for other adults in other jobs to be returning? And I'll just preface this by saying, I sometimes think that that's a really false pairing. You know, it seems to me that in some ways, if the idea is everybody should stay apart from one another as much as they can, then the question becomes, who can't do that? And so if we're thinking that the balance is weighed in favor of students returning to school, then other people staying home would actually benefit the students and the faculty and staff who are returning to schools. But I understand Kenny's question as well, as like, well, you know, from Kenny's perspective, this doesn't seem fair to be saying these people have to return when state office workers are making that decision and don't have to return.
Sure. I guess I would remind people of the overall context. We have lowest prevalence rate in the country for COVID-19. And given overall population risk, we're saying that for those populations who are able to continue to stay home and function relatively normally, they should. For a lot of kids, remote learning doesn't make a lot of sense. Kids learn better when they're in school. Kids socially develop better when they're around their peers. If we thought it was very dangerous, we would not recommend they go back. So we're not saying that come hell or high water, you know, you should be in school. We're saying, given Vermont's context, given everything we know about what's happening in Vermont, it makes sense for kids to be in school. If we had to bring all staff back into the buildings, we would move forward on that. We don't have to. So it's looking at the overall population and saying who needs to be in contact, who doesn't. In the same way that we know that it's safer for older people right now in Vermont than it was back in March, but we're still really exercising a lot of caution about elderly people in long-term care facilities and still encouraging people to be very thoughtful about how they visit, even though that is a different situation than it was back in March. So every population is slightly different.
Steve wrote in to say it's vital to be clear that remote education is not a solved problem for young kids. It's very insufficient compared to in-person. I do not indict teachers here, Steve says, but we need to be clear that every school day that is skipped, 12 out of 14 so far this year for my kids, is a step backwards. A typical remote day will be 45 to 75 minutes, only 15 minutes with a teacher, the rest with aides. This isn't a replacement for school. Kids with the fewest resources at home will suffer the most. Dr. Lee, is that part of the balancing that you do as you weigh the health value of being in person versus the health risk of being in person?
Absolutely. As has already been commented, we know that, especially for younger learners, remote learning just is not a good way for those children to learn. And not only that, we also need to remember and recognize all of the other functions that school serves, both to families and to the community. For many children, that is a location where they are able to get necessary and needed services, including reliable meals. For some children, unfortunately, school is physically the safest place for them to be. Having kids at school allows parents and other community members to return to be able to do their jobs and function as well. So, you know, I think when we talk about schools and the risks, we really need to balance the very small risks in Vermont with all of the benefits we know will accrue to having kids back in school, not just in terms of academics and education, but all of the other social developmental benefits that school attendance provides. And I did want to also echo a comment that you had made a short while ago. We as a community, we all need to sort of pitch in and help continue to keep Vermont as safe as possible. And, you know, that sometimes may involve trade-offs. And so if there are workers who can do their job reasonably well from home, then that is a great trade-off to make, because then that keeps the potential or possibility for infection in the community down. And it makes our schools that much safer for the kids to return to. You know, I do think that at the end of the day, when we look at the risks versus the benefits, overwhelmingly the benefits for the kids and for their families to being back in school in person just completely dwarfs the low risk of infection that we see here in Vermont currently.
And we got a question from Cherie in Burlington who says, is there a saliva testing option for the general public or for a specific group? How can one go about using this testing if it is available? Deputy Commissioner?
Sure. There is no saliva test that we're using in Vermont right now. UVM was using a saliva test for students before they arrived. But we are not using one right now in Vermont. But that is part of what that scientific advisory committee is doing, looking at the variety of tests and which ones might be on the horizon. But at this time, we are sticking with the tests that we have.
We got a note from Scott in Montpelier, Dr. Lee, who's responding to your comments about how frequently you should wash your mask. And you said wash it every day. Wash your kid's mask is what we were talking about in particular. But I assume that also applies to adults. And so Scott says, if the recommendation is to wash the mask after one day, does that mean to wash it if you wear it for 8 hours? Or would you wear it for 8 days for 1 hour and then wash it? Or could you wear it 16 days for 30 minutes, et cetera? It seems like one day is slightly arbitrary, no? So how would you determine when it's appropriate to wash your mask? You know, is it based on a full day or is it based on just basically one wearing, however long that is?
So that's a great question. So there's a lot of nuance to this, obviously. For me, just from a practical standpoint, I fully acknowledge that, you know, if somebody wore their mask one day for just half an hour, you know, maybe that isn't necessarily the same as the same person wearing a mask for 12 hours straight. I think just for practical purposes, it's probably just easiest for folks just to make a habit of just whatever mask they were using that day, just take it off at the end of the day and put it in a separate pile to wash. Again, I don't know that I can say that's necessarily evidence-based or science-based, but just from a purely practical standpoint and getting back to what we were speaking earlier, just being able to keep track of all the masks more easily, that just seems to me the most practical way to approach it.
Yeah. Tracy Dolan, you want to weigh in on that, or are you not going to touch that one?
No, I think I agree with Dr. Lee. There's no science that says it's exactly 8 hours or it's 3 days with 2.5 hours each. Do what makes sense for you. If it makes sense to put it all in the wash every day, do that. But generally, they should be clean and as clean as possible. And so, you know, do what makes sense for you. But you don't want to be having the same mask on day after day after day until it gets soiled.
Let's go to Peter, who's calling in from Moortown now. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call.
Of course.
I'm a high school educator, and I'd like to ask a question about this classification of close contacts as being someone within 6 feet of an infected person for 15 minutes or more. Not only have I been seeing studies in the news that are talking about aerosol spreading farther than 6 feet, but we're trying to do our best to keep those protocols in place at the school I work at. I think everyone's doing a really great job, but there are still those times I'm reminding students in my classes, you know, please put your mask over your nose. There's times when I might not notice that someone doesn't have the mask over their nose. There are times where we're trying to space students while they're eating and ask them not to speak while they're eating to cut down on the spread of talking when they're unmasked. Some students aren't following those protocols. We're then giving them reminders, trying to space them even farther apart. So I just think in practice, that classification of close contact just doesn't work. And I'd like to know what your guests think about that. Thank you.
Peter, thanks for the call and for sharing what it's been like from your experience in a classroom. Deputy Commissioner Dolan.
Sure. And so I think the question is about how do we continue to keep that social distancing happening?
Well, what I think more so, and Peter, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but you're more so asking, like, what's the definition of a close contact? And if the assumption is you're not necessarily a close contact just because you've been in the same school environment, it sounds like Peter's saying within the school environment, practically speaking, it is much harder to follow the distancing protocols that have been laid out by the state. So how are we classifying and determining who might be a close contact? Peter, do I have that correct?
You have the correct, yeah. I'm, like, for example, if multiple students in my class are needing reminders to put their mask over their nose, now I'm thinking that everyone in the room even though, you know, best case scenario, they're masked and 6 feet apart, all of a sudden now we have breathing going on, which would, based on the studies I'm seeing in major news sources, would classify the whole room as a potential close contact. And so I'm wondering why the state keeps with that 6 foot, 15 minute rule.
Okay. Tracy Dolan?
Sure. It's CDC guidance, and so far it has done us well. We've been using that definition throughout, and we seem to catch a lot of the close contacts with that definition. When we go more broadly and we then test asymptomatics who do not appear to be close contacts, for the most part, they're not testing positive. And so we're finding that those who are testing positive tend to be within the definition that was provided. And it is possible that if a student is in a smaller pod, I'm going to use that word to describe, you know, the group of students that they're regularly around, they may all be identified as a close contact if it's a smaller classroom, even if the kids didn't spend a lot of time close to each other, recognizing that throughout the day, and if they're there for many hours, you know, they may have that closer contact over time periodically. But the whole school that we wouldn't recommend, we don't call that a close contact, even though there are times when kids are walking through the hallway that their mask might be off for a period of time or incorrectly placed and that they're showing their nose and so breathing that way. But generally, we're using the CDC guidance. Generally, it appears to be working for us. And given what we know about the low incidence of students with COVID-19, we're going to stick with that. But recognizing that, you know, occasionally there may be a case where we need to ask a few more questions and include a broader number of kids.
I wonder, too, if we'll see as time progresses that the school environment is significantly different or more or less the same to other spaces where there are, you know, groups of people or significant numbers of people, because, you know, we haven't done this with schools yet. So it's going to be interesting to see, I suppose, as we move forward, you know, what actually happens in practice.
Yeah, we're learning as we go. What we know right now is, you know, there are 40,000 students here in college right now. And I think as of today, we don't have a single one in quarantine or isolation. And so we do know it is possible for people to be gathering together with the right guidelines. In the case of the people who came from out of state, you know, they quarantined in advance. The lucky thing that we've got, of course, with students here in Vermont is that for the most part, they're Vermonters. Hopefully they did not do a lot of traveling. We really discouraged that prior to the school year. So we will continue to see more cases, probably even in the next week. And some of those might be holdovers from before they attended school. But we will continue with that definition unless, you know, science tells us otherwise.
Let's get a call in from Jessica, who's on the line from Essex. Hi, Jessica.
Hi there.
Go right ahead.
So my question is, we're a homeschool family and we really have the opportunity to kind of shut it down and not do a lot of stuff, but I'm finding myself mitigating our risk and weighing, like, is a dance class inside with three kids more appropriate than like 15 kids at a scouting event outside? And I just get really confused about, like, what we should be participating in and what we should maybe try to avoid.
Dr. Lee, could you tackle that? How should Jessica try to figure out which extracurriculars might be safer than others?
I think that the general principles that we've discussed earlier can potentially help guide some of this decision-making. I do believe that activities that can be performed outside, and particularly those that can be performed outside and at reasonable distance, those are going to be the safer activities. Now, that doesn't mean that some of those other activities can't be done, but those are really the things that I would look at closely in terms of any individual scenario. Could this be done outside? Could this be done at greater distance? If not, how many people are involved in indoor environment? Is everybody wearing masks or not? I really would emphasize that with more experience, one of the things that's become just so abundantly clear is how important masking actually is in terms of preventing transmission. And so the scenarios that I would try to avoid at all costs is large groups of people indoors, unmasked, doing things that might increase either respiratory rate or involve more vocalization. So that's why, for example, we believe now that probably one of the biggest risk activities is people singing indoors together, because that sort of breaks all of those rules that that we've been talking about. So much like a lot of the questions surrounding COVID-19, I can't really give a firm or definite answer, but those are the principles that I would just be thinking about as you kind of go through the decision-making process of what feels of what could be done safely and what activities potentially should be avoided.
We're nearing the end of the show, but let's see if we can get one more call in from Lisa, who's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, thank you very much. My question is about aerosols, the fall and winter weather coming, so the cold weather with windows closed, and what measures can be taken to protect people who live in apartment buildings and so they share their ventilating and heating system. What can be done to protect as much as possible the air quality during the COVID season in the cold weather?
Lisa, thanks for the call. So many questions about how to make sure that we're properly ventilating and doing the best we can. Tracy Dolan, could you answer, Lisa?
Sure. As we move toward winter, we all have that on our minds. We've been talking about that at the Department of Health, too. For now, we're recommending that people keep windows open and increase the airflow. And we recognize that will be a little more challenging as we move toward the winter. Hopefully, we're going to start seeing a different pattern as we move toward the winter, as kids and students are in college and we continue to see low incidence rate. But that's probably the best you can do at this time, is ensure that you have some airflow coming into your apartment. And then, of course, all the other things that remain so important: wash hands, use a mask, socially distance, stay home when you're sick. Those are the four biggies. While we do recognize that air quality is an issue, that doesn't appear at this time to be a major transmitter in Vermont in terms of the cases that we've seen.
So many people, though, you know, think about that in their normal lives pre-COVID, too. I know a lot of Vermonters who keep their windows open, whether or not that's advisable in the wintertime. And so, you know, as schools and office buildings try to think about, you know, the proper way to ventilate and be as safe as possible while also worrying about heating bills, you know, do you hear that sort of cropping up? It sounds like, Tracy Dolan, you're already talking about that at the health department, and I know it came up for schools as well. But is that something you think Vermonters are going to be asking about this fall and winter?
It is. I don't know about the heating bill aspect, but I think people are already asking. Certainly the colleges are already asking. You know, right now you can still drive by schools and see some outdoor classrooms. You're going to see that less as it gets colder. Although, you know, there are some schools that continue to get kids outside. So we would encourage anyone to go outside. A, great for exercise. B, great for being able to do something that's safe in the COVID area. But recognizing that opening windows would be ideal, you know, pile on the sweaters. And of course, don't let it get too dangerously cold in your home.
Well, I look forward to VPR creating the Outdoor Vermont Edition studio. We don't have it yet, but maybe by winter we can have it, and I'll just wear my snowsuit. Tracy Dolan is Deputy Commissioner for the Vermont Department of Health. Thank you, as always, Deputy Commissioner. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And Dr. Benjamin Lee is a pediatric infectious disease specialist at the University of Vermont Children's Hospital. Dr. Lee, thank you very much for your time and expertise.
Thank you.